First of all, I'd like to remember we're all that wonderful day that came from. If you ever want to publish something, NGS Fortin, you're not going to get an entry of an article or a review until all of your choices are cited in. They have some standards, so the citation is here and you can be basically perfect and near perfect. Just generally, whenever you have information you put in the database, I think it's fair to give credit where that information came from. When you start talking about evaluating evidence and the data that you have in the database, you really need to know the source of that data in order to properly evaluate it. And when you have conflicts in your data, you have one record that says somebody was married on one date, you got another record that says they were married on a different date. Hopefully you have two different sources that link to those records. And having the proper source documentation allows you to potentially decide which of those marriage dates is the most correct date that you want to use in your database. And then, of course, if you're doing any lineage society, especially DAR and SAR and some of the others, you do need to cite your sources. You may not generate that as a report right out of TMG, but you do need to capture that data. And it's very difficult to fill out one of those applications correctly with all of your source citations 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 years after you found the information, unless you captured all the information at your sources contemporaneously as you're doing your research and going to get the TMG. And I think research is also very important when you're giving your information and to your descendants or wherever you're going to inherit your database at the end of your research period. That's the way to say it when you stop research. Now, looking back at chapter 6, talking about sources, I just want to go over a couple of things. Actually, recycling some slides I used about a year and a half ago with some updates and changes, focusing on type of customization we're doing today. Sources, we're using all kinds of sources, books, talking to a person, things that we saw and remember, microfilms, index cards and information that might be there, or research reports or other bulletins of information at the time. We find these all over the place. Libraries, the closets, in the attic at CCN's house, on the internet, etc. We always want to identify the source, use the source, but we want to report the data, get the tags and the information on the tags. We also want to record the information about that source. And so when we identify a source, we use a lot of items that may apply to the source. Not every one of these identifying items applies completely to every source that you might encounter. But things like the author, the title, the call number, type of item, the page number, fish number, publication date, the URL of the repository. There are all these types of things that can describe a source. And it's these descriptive terms, identifying terms about a source that we're really going to be focusing on in this presentation as we come to see how you identify sources and then how you may have reasons why you want to take the source types that are in TMG and make modifications to them or customize them in order to change or add source identifying information. Now here's a quick example. I know you can't really read the image of the page on the left there. You know, it's really getting that their chapter does not do nearly as good a job as I'm screening straight notes. Here's a page out of the book title page. This is a book that I found very useful, although it's an example of a book that you use it as a clue about information. But when people are being interviewed about folks buried in a cemetery, buried there 150 years ago, which is a brick or brick or grandparent, you have to take the interview information with a grain of salt. That's generally not first or second hand information. It's family traditions being passed down. Anyway, this book just so happened they had written the call number on the index page. The published date, it really didn't say published, but it said copyright. survival book, the Holesville Cemetery. It was compiled by the Holesville Cemetery Association Book Committee and published by a couple of companies that were located in Crozier City, Louisiana, and Longview, Texas. Now, another term to look at is source type. And in TMG, the word source type is used to identify classification of sources like Bible, census, birth certificate, book. And by type, these are generally things for which you're going to be finding one or more books or one or more sources of that type in your research. And so the type kind of defines how you're going to document the information about a book. And then each book is separately documented in your database as a source list. The data fields that document the source are very important to us. And I put this in italics to remind you. If you never publish an article or a report, and if you never publish a bibliography or endnotes or footnotes, I think you'll still want to pay a lot of attention to source data and customization, because the master source list is that rich information about where the data came from. When I talk about customization, a lot of the focus of this presentation is on printing out a Elizabeth Schoenmill's perfect bibliography and tuning things up so it looks perfect, or making it perfect for an NGS quarterly. But really, the perfect output is going to depend a whole lot upon having the right information captured out of that source. And whether you ever publish a bibliography, you want to be capturing the right information to describe the source that you use. And we'll re-emphasize that point in a minute. Now, a source type in TMG then includes not only data fields that describe the source, but what are called templates for reporting the sources and footnotes, endnotes, and bibliographies. Now, we talk source types. You get the source types by going into tools and then the source type item. I'll demonstrate this in a minute. But you get a screen that looks like this. It has a big drop-down list, and you scroll through there to find the source type that you want. And in TMG 7, there are about 100 source types based upon Elizabeth Schoenmill's book that she did in 97. It was called Evidence, Citing and Analysis of Family Historian. And so, as Holy Jean said, they took their best effort at capturing most of those ways of types of sources and ways of doing footnotes and bibliography, and they created those as part of the overall structure that's available to us at TMG. You can, of course, extend that 100, and that's what we're talking about today, modifying templates, modifying source types, and adding to that modification of the data. Now, another important term is TMG source categories. TMG has a collection of source types. One of the collections is based upon Mill's book from 1997. Another collection is from the book of Cite Your Sources in 1980. It's a much simpler look at the types of sources that you can be dealing with. And then you can do custom sources. How many do custom sources instead of sticking strictly with them? I have used custom so long, I forget what switching to custom gives you, or what sticking with Mill or Lackey limits you to. I kind of forget what that math means. When you say you want to go to custom sources, or initially setting up your TMG preferences, the system will ask you if you want to initially populate your custom sources either from Lackey or Mill, and I select Lackey. So I think everything in my presentation, I select Mill. So everything in my presentation really deals with 100 plus that you get from Mill, even with set those custom types. Now, you set the selection by going to preferences, current project options, other, and there is a drop down box. You really have only three choices. choices to go with as drawn from evidence by Mills, as drawn from sites and sources by Lackey, or going custom. Now, a typical report that we get out is going to have little superscript numbers beside each of the tags state sends, and it will be identifying where that information came from. So this is the citation ID. And you see there's several of them in this document that goes on and on through that document. That then links to endnotes. Endnotes are where it said one, that references the little superscript one, is linking to the family Bible of John Alexander and Lila Woods. And then two, three, four, on and on and on and on through there. I was kind of reviewing this chart yesterday and didn't get a chance to fix it. I pulled this from something where I was playing with the source or with the sample database many, many months ago when we were looking at Lumper and Slitter. So I've got some extraneous stuff in this report just reminding me of what's hidden there. A bibliography. The other thing you'll be generating when you're doing a more formal distribution of your data along with your source information is to print out the bibliography. And this kind of completes the picture about what were the sources used in that particular report. And again, I circled some things that are kind of erroneous for being in a bibliography. I would have corrected it, but I have some other things I was working on. Didn't have time to go back and fix my database. But again, a bibliography is a structured listing of the sources which were cited in a particular report output. Not every source in your database, it's only those sources that are used in a specific output report. Now, let's get into chapter 15 after I've gone through a few minutes of background here. Important terminology I think everyone needs to understand. Local and global source templates, I'm going to say here, there, or everywhere. This term local versus global is kind of a Terry legal set of terms. In TMG, occasionally the word global is used, and local once or twice, I think. But he makes the distinction, and I'll follow the distinction, that a lot of the customization we're going to be doing, you have to recognize that local meaning only one small place. Or are you doing the customization in a place that's global, which means it's going to affect a wide range of instances in your database? That's a very important thing to understand. Otherwise, you're going to start encountering results that you didn't really anticipate in your database. Now, source templates pretty much always look like this, where you have a full footnote template, a short footnote template, and a bibliography. If you're using a book like Mills' New Book, which amazing, to be honest with you, this book is so much thicker because this thing kind of tells you the results of a lot of thought and analysis on citing sources. This book tells you virtually every nuance about how she came up with a lot of the decisions that she now put forth as the guidelines for human source citation. And it gets down to minutia detail, and there are a lot of things in here, you know, like the difference between Polish or information on Polish records, Czechoslovakian records, English records, you know, all these different languages. You kind of skip through some of those little sections, but it's a tremendous amount of plus, she has extensive examples, which helps a lot. But don't pick that book up and just read it and find a sample and use it. I'll give you an illustration of that later on. What we're going to be talking about here really is the stuff that's inside the box in these source templates, although there are several different things that we're going to customize that aren't exactly inside that box. Again, re-emphasizing the thing about local versus global. Local is a template for one specific individual source, like that Paulsville Cemetery book. That is one source underlying that source site, or that source in the master source list, is a template that's going to describe how that source is going to be represented in endnotes, footnotes, and bibliography. But that's only one source. That's local. So if I make a change about that source, it only applies to that one book, even though there may be many, many compiled record books in my database. Global is the template for a source type, like the source type book of compiled records. And a change at the global level is going to be used in each source of that type. And I use that term kind of with a caveat that there are exceptions that will be used in each source of that type. So global is done at the source definition level, and global means at the source type definition level. You really need to understand source is an individual book, of which there are going to be dozens of books that follow that pattern. Source type is a category of books, and you're changing them back. Every instance of a book within that category, so that's a global. Now, deciding if you want to modify a template to global or global, kind of think about this. Are you trying to change one template for one time only? One change that, you know, this is the only place you want to use that change. Or are you making a change to a template and you want that template to be used every time in the future? When you're going to have another source of that particular document. For example, a lot of books are compiled records and they may have a compiler listed in the documentation of that. Some compiled record documents also have an editor who went through and did some selection about what records got in the compiled. You may decide that your compiled record template should allow you to put in both the compiler of the data and the editor of the data. So you would go in and change the source type for a compiled book of compiled records so that it has two fields, one for editor and one for compiler. And then you would be making a change. It kind of reminds you in the future to look and see if there was an editor as well as a compiler. And as I will demonstrate my last example, is a new source type for future use, something that's not just a modification of an existing type, but creating one totally from scratch. First, why do you customize these sources? Well, I gave one example there that you recognize that you want to have an editor as well as a compiler for a book that's a compiled book. But maybe you just don't like the template. You know, if you're not going to publish an NGS quarterly, you don't really care what it looks like, shown it looks like when you print it out. What you really want to capture is the data so that you can go back to your source and look for more information or verify information to the source, or you're catching information about the source so that when you think about the data 3 years from now, you can kind of remember back and say, oh yeah, that came from that kind of flaky cemetery book, and that's what my documentation said. That cemetery book had very good data, but also be careful with that data. So you maybe just don't like the template and want to do something a little bit different. You may have some supplemental data. An example of that is I often will go to a library and find information in a book, and I'll take some notes, but I'll Xerox several pages out of that book. The title page, the page that has information on it, and maybe there are several pages that I'm trying to copy. And I'll staple those together, and then in my notebook, I'll write some notes that I, you know, picked up that book, used the data, found some data, and when I get home, I really need to finish pulling all the information out of the database, into, or out of the book, out of the copy of the book, and sticking it into my database. Well, I track that with what I call an accession number. That's such a unique number. But I put the date and the number on every little thing, that every scrap of paper that I generate. And then, in my notebook, I say that I got this book and it's accession number 2011-09-09-01. 1, and that number is written on the Xerox copy. And so that number kind of tracks that around. And I pull that data into my database, and that Xerox copy goes off and it's been stacked stuff. And I say, where's my Xerox copy? Well, I started a long time ago, but I'm making the progress, and taking all those sheets of paper and getting them organized. And because my session number is basically calendar day plus another value, they're basically in chronological order. And I did it that way instead of following it by person, because a lot of the things I find are about more than one person. So whose file do you put the information about five people? Which file do you put it in? So I just decided to have a stack of these documents that I have here. Now, a couple of times I had to look something up, and I know where to look for it. Should over file is all organized, or the three boxes are unorganized, but no one moved with it. So putting the session number on my sources is one of the supplemental data that I'm adding. You may not have templates as best effectively support new sources, and that's part of the difference between this and this. Certainly in 1997, when we were using the web, but a lot of things have really changed. 12 years, and the use of the internet and the availability of data. And I think Elizabeth Schoenfeld has really gone to the extreme in trying to document all of the variations of information that are available to us now, and a lot of explanation that actually comes up with the guidelines. There are other things you may want to do. You just may not like Mills, but you want to do it your own way. Maybe you're a rebel nonconformist. Just want to build a source template that says book in the corner, and that's all you really want to record about it. Make all kinds of reasons why you want to customize, but all of those reasons are going to drive the way you make the customization. Now, going back to the terms of local and global, if you want to do a modification locally, that means you're modifying a template. And I say the word template, there's one other place where you make a modification that's actually in the source definition stream that doesn't directly affect the template. I'll show that. But you're making a change for one source only, like that Hallsville Cemetery book example. And that modification, if I have another book that I'm going to record, and I want the same modification, I have to also modify template for that other book, because the modification I did for the first book does not apply to the second book. So I have to redo that modification every time I want to make that modification happen. So that's one of the things about local. It applies one time only. Even if you want to replicate it three or four times, you're going to have to enter three or four times. Globally, think of it as more of a master template or a master structure for a source type. That's where you modify the source type, and it's going to apply to all new sources of that type. So if I change the source type template for a book of compiled records, then every time in the future when I add a new book of compiled records, that change is going to appear on my screen, and I can now use that change. Also, if you make a change to a source type, that will automatically change all sources in your database that use that source type, unless that source type had already been modified at local level. So it's kind of an exception to an exception here. I don't know if I can really illustrate that, but think about one-time changes and global or multiple changes. I always want to do it this way. That's the primary difference between local global in the way that Terry Regal uses those terms. Now, where do you do these modifications? Locally, you do that when you are creating a new source definition or editing the source definition. Globally, you make the change when you're editing the source type and the source type stream. So here's the source definition screen. We're kind of used to seeing this when we're putting in a source definition. And there is the title on the screen, the upper left-hand corner. And it really is washed out on that screen there. Sort of on templates for describing a full footnote, a short footnote, and the bibliography. One other thing I'll kind of point out here, and we'll make this happen live in a few minutes. You see the word overridden right there. And you see it right here, but you don't see it in the bibliography. That's a human cursor. Whenever you see the word overridden in a template, that means the template that you're looking at has one or more changes from the template in the source type. So while this is a source type that is derived, while this is a source derived from the source type, it has changes in it from what you would find back in the global source type definition. Unfortunately, when you look at this screen, you can't tell where the changes are. You don't know what changed, you just know that what's in that template field had a change, and that it's different from the standard or the source type definition. Same thing right here. But this one, since it does not have the word overridden, is meaning it's identical to what's in the source type definition from the same source. So it's in the source definition screen on the output form, although there's one other way of modifying this that I'll show you, where you do local customization. Similarly, when you want to make changes to source type, you will see a screen that looks like this. What is the source type that you're now getting ready to edit and modify? And you're going to see the templates for the full footnote, short footnote, bibliography. And also, this thing about reminder. And perhaps reminder is one of the most, for me, is one of the most significant minor enhancements to TMG, to TM version 7 or 6.2 or something like that. Because it really has changed the way I think about customizing sources. I'll try to explain that in a little more detail as we go through. But this is where you do the source type change. Again, the source type, if I come in there and make a change to the source type ancestral file, when I hit OK, that change, the formatting changes for footnotes, bibliography, or reminders, are going to propagate to all ancestral file sources that I've cited, with the exception that those have already been modified at the local level. So this is where you do your global customization. Now I want to do a little bit of a TMG demonstration here. Kind of put some things moving from PowerPoint to live, just so we can go back through the steps here. If I want to look at something locally, go on Tools, source list, and then here are all of the sources that are in this database. This is the sample database restored back to it. The original came in 2007, the original version of it, with a couple of modifications that I made to get ready for this presentation. I had to go back to a distribution disk for TMG to find a pure, clean sample database that you probably, like me, tinker with the sample database. Try things for reports and stuff like that. As you saw, we're adding things about lumber and splitter. You can have all kinds of junk left in your sample database, and it can come along and do things that you really didn't expect to accept. So if I want to deal with something locally, again, I come into the master source list and I say, which one of those do I want to change? Now, I said I want to edit. My note says go to source 39, and I didn't realize the screen was going to get this small. So I have to come over here and sort, and then go to source 39. Here is source number 39, and here's the template, and the components of the template, we'll go back through this again, talking about some of these components that are here, but again, again, I want you to just look at the general tab, and then they'll go to the output tab, and in the output tab, you see again the information, the templates for footnotes, and bibliography. In this case, you see that the footnote for the full footnote has been overridden. The short footnote is standard according to the source type, and then in the sample database, somebody has made some change somewhere in that bibliography. The word overridden appears under the item name right there when you change one or more spaces or characters in the template. I mean, if I came up here and put in a space, I want to be caught right there, just that one space, instantly customize that template, and TMG immediately flagged it as that the master template from the source type has been overridden in this instance. So it happens very quickly, very easy to make a change. And if I backspace and eliminate that one little trivial change, it's a whoop, now you're back to master, matching the source type. So that's where you do your editing for customizing, and customization can be as trivial as putting in an extra blank space inside a template. Now, the other type of modification is the global modification. All sources belong to one source type, and there are, I think, 32 source types in TMG. Right there is a little, the one that's blue, something I added for demonstration after the break. But here are the source types, and as you scroll through the source types, you notice the information being displayed for the footnotes changes. And that's actually pretty handy because if you don't really, if you're dealing with birth registration, local level versus state level, and you're kind of confused, you're not 100% sure which one to use, perhaps looking at the field data that are going to go into the source citation may help you decide which one of them is the one you use. Here, an authored book and a compiled book. Just flipping back and forth, you see there are some differences. It's kind of hard to catch how many differences there are, but if you're trying to decide if this is an authored book, a compiled book, or an edited book, looking at the templates may give you a clue that helps you make that decision. Usually it's not that ambiguous, but again, you go through here and you can find what you're looking for as far as what source type. If you want to modify that source type, then you click on that source type and you're now ready to do editing of that source type. And start putting things in on that source type. And then now becomes the standard of that source type for all instances of books with compiled records. And I just made a nonsensical change putting 4S or something there. But this is where to do editing global changes for source types. Now, editing the templates. How many people have done editing of templates beyond just playing? Several people have done. I've done several fairly serious edits, meaning more than just one field and stuff like that. And I've created several templates that I wanted to create both as a learning curve and then also I was finding that some records that I wanted to, some sources that I wanted to document, I could find how to document that and build that new book. This is actually great too. But I could not find something in TMG that I thought was close enough. And so I decided that I will build a source template from scratch rather than simply tweaking or customizing an existing source template. And building one from scratch is just customizing, except you're starting from a blank screen and building in all of your lines. It's very important when you're working with sources, source customization, where you're creating a new one or making changes, to really understand the components of those templates and where data comes from to compose a footnote, a short footnote, or a bibliography. And it is not as simple as one might think, but it's actually pretty simple once you begin to get the bigger picture and pay attention to the detail of drawing the picture. There are a lot of things that make up these templates. Source elements, text, punctuation, conditional brackets, and format. When we look at the template, it kind of looks like that. Family data, comma, short title, comma, ital, colon, Bible title, colon, ital, left bracket, comma. Doesn't read like English. That is an illustration of source elements, text, punctuation, conditional brackets, and formatting. And if you have worked with customization of sentences, this works almost the same way, with almost the same guideline structure, editing, it's almost the same, but it's not exactly the same. It's customized, it's not very close. The components that make up a template start with things like source elements. That is an individual field that defines something about a source. Title, author, etc. Most of the source elements that are going to go into a template for a footnote or a bibliography appear in the general tab of the source definition screen. They are designated with square brackets. Some examples of these are title, notice the square brackets, author, square brackets, date, record group, CD1, meaning the first piece of citation detail, repository information, etc. So as we build a template, or as you work with templates or look at templates, all of those pieces of the template that are in these square brackets are meant to be elements, source elements. You can use square brackets for other purposes, but the things that are in the square brackets are generally source elements. Text. When you look at a template, in addition to the field of data that come from source elements, you're going to see some text fields, like the word compiled in front of the field word compiled. You're going to see text that that text that goes into the template, though, is not searchable. And I'm going to make that point in a minute here and illustrate that point, and then hopefully you'll say, aha, I just understood what it is. Not searchable, now I know why I don't want to do what it is in the image statement database. And obviously, text is composed of letters and the alphabet, numbers, and probably some special characters. But examples of that, you'll see in a template things like herein cited as, bracket, as title, bracket. Herein cited as, kind of that faded red in there, is text. And then S title is a source element. And so the output that's going to be generated from that little fragment of the template is going to say, herein after cited as, and whatever data you enter, that's the short title for your source. And then it'll be stuck in the output and the bibliography of the equipment. Other examples, the word editor is a name of a person, and then you could tag after the name of the person the title, which is editor. So an editor is editor, you have compiler, and stuff like that. Things like URLs. Instead of just having something word after it says www.whatever. With the text title that says online, and then it helps keep the combination and follow the URL. So these texts that appear in the templates are providing a little more explanatory data about the composition of the text and the outputting that comes out and put them in the document. Don't get carried away in the text. If you're documenting a letter, it may want to say the author, but the author of the letter from that person as opposed to the author of the book. Punctuation. As you compose the templates for a footnote or a bibliography, there are conventions and standards as illustrated in here. You kind of read a couple of rules about colons, semicolons, periods, and stuff like that. I'm kind of never going to remember all those rules. Really, I just mimic or copy the punctuation that I see in her example. If she has title, comma, I put a comma after the title. I don't really know what the rule is why you separate the title from the edition number with a comma. I don't know what the rule is for that. She said title, comma, edition. I did the title, the comma, edition. The comma is just one of these punctuation marks that goes in there. Punctuation is just like text. It really has no significance other than the visual and then ultimately how the information is read by somebody. But example, period, comma, the brackets are actually can be used. Normally if you have an editorial note in a text document, you'll put an editorial note in square brackets. And you can put square brackets with text in a template for a footnote or a bibliography. It's just remember that the square brackets also tell CMG that this is a source element. And so you may have a note that gets interpreted as a source element, and CMG will tell you that a source element can't be found or something like that. You can also use parentheses. I suppose there's some other punctuation marks on the keyboard, copyright, things like that. When I hit text, you could also add special characters, foreign language characters, umlauts, and stuff like that. That all counts as text. That's the assembly of things. Template has source elements and includes punctuation marks. Conditional brackets. Sometimes you might have a template where you know that some of the information that ought to go in the template not always available from the information about a source, or it may not apply. I gave the example of a compiled record document that may have a compiler, but sometimes you may also have an editor. And so, compiled record, you would always expect to have somebody listen to the compiler. You may occasionally have someone listen to the organization that's the editor. And so, the compiler information is kind of mandatory information in that source citation. But the editor, if it's there, put it in. If it's not there, skip it. So that's kind of the conditional type thing. Conditional values are always designated with these open and closed characters, or brackets or anything, and such like a return. Occasionally, you will see a conditional item has punctuation inside the brackets, like comma CD. So it says, if there is citation detail, print it, but separate it from the things in front of it with a comma. If there is no citation detail, blank. Just don't print it. Here's another one. A text entry volume is there, followed by a source element volume. So if in the source definition you put something in the volume field, then the output is going to say volume space 7, or whatever data value you put into the volume number. If there is no volume information input in the source definition field, it's going to be blank because the word volume and the source element volume are conditional. Not there, so it's not going to put any data there that fills up space with nothingness in your output. If you see something like author and it doesn't have carrot or angle bracket, whatever it's called around, then it's not conditional. That's required. And there are many places where the PMG can remind you that they require, although you can continue and leave something blank that's required, you are going to get out some nasty little notes in there like this. There's also a formatting control that can be done as with sentences. You can make them italics, bold, underline. The standards and conventions like fields kind of dictate what the formatting is. You achieve that by putting in a control code inside the square brackets, control, colon, to begin it, and then square bracket, colon, control is the way you end. So the colon mark basically gives you the beginning and ending of that format. An example is putting something in italics, as they have here. You have the control code, italics, and then whatever is between that and the next control code will be printed in italics. And then this final one ends it up. Looking through all of the templates, I think italics is the only format control that I find actually used in templates from footnotes and bibliographies. But you can use other format control systems. Again, the standards and guidelines seem to only use normal text and italics for formats. Now I want to demonstrate a couple of things here, and I'll show you the cheat sheet and which demonstration I'm doing. Any questions so far? I'm going to make a couple of changes to local changes to a particular source. And again, I want to do source number one. And I mean, here's one other thing right here. See, the sources are sorted one to two. You know, remember, if you click on something, like right there, click on abbreviation, it's now going to sort all of the sources by what appears in the abbreviation column. I come over here, and I'm trying to look for source number one. There it is, but if I click on the column header source, and bounce around. Now I put source, you know, it sorts everything in order by source. So let me go into this Alexander Keebler Bible. A little bit of screen control issue here. Here is a Bible record. It says it's a Bible record. It comes from the source type of Bible. It has the abbreviation. The abbreviation is not a source element. You cannot reference the abbreviation in the template. It's kind of a special field to set where a document is going to appear when you look in the master sheet system. It's kind of the main port. An example of where that can be used is I'm citing a lot of my sources in foreign language, in the original foreign language, which Mills recommends. But I'm putting in my abbreviations English language abbreviated things, like church book instead of church book. Stuff like that. So I'm putting English language names in the abbreviation. Again, that is not a source field that can be used in a template. Here are the various source fields that are being captured in the general screen. I want to go to the output tab and I realize I'm going to show you another little item here that I have scribbling that only I can read. Here, you will notice that the footnote for this Bible entry says it's been overwritten. Here you see the footnote for the template for the short footnote has been overwritten. If you decide that you want to reset a local template, local meaning for a specific source, back to its original source template form from the source type, you just select the whole template is there and delete it. And what that does, you notice the word overridden disappeared. And what's in here is slightly different from what was there when I entered this spring. But this is now reset so that this template for the full footnote from this Bible citation is now the footnote that came from the Sword Current template for a full footnote in the source type for a Bible record.
Now, John, how did you remove the overwriting?
Okay, let's do it. Fortunately, this one had two. I can do it twice, and then I'm going to make it override here again. You make it override as happens in a number of places in TMG. That if you delete something, you don't really delete it. It just resets it back to the original value. So here, where I have short footnote and parenthetically overridden, which says this, whatever's here for a short footnote is not what the source template defines in the short footnote. I simply select all of the items, and then I hit my delete key, and it deletes what was there, replaces it with the short footnote full from the source type for a Bible, and then because we now match what's in the source type short footnote for a Bible, the word overridden disappeared. So that's how you find a template for a particular source, and it says overridden, and you can't remember why it's overridden. That's how you go back and tell TMG, put it back to the scan. And it does it for just that one source change.
But if you click OK after doing that, you've lost any of those changes that were there before.
In the template.
For that.
Yeah. And I think my little example here just realized I might be able to show one other funny thing that you can do. Okay, let's just say that this template right here, you know, I say, man, that's a great template for a family Bible record. But this family Bible that I have over here has some characteristic that I really want to remember about that characteristic. And so I say, what I'd like to do in that bibliography is write that after the Bible in addition, but before the word author, I want to remember that this is a particular item type, which is another source field, and a little space right there. Now, a couple of things to illustrate here. When I hit my first keystroke, you may have noticed the word overridden popped up here. I've seen that a couple of times now, where as soon as you start changing a template, it's going to tell you it's overridden. Immediately. Doesn't matter what you're doing. Putting in a space, adding a new source field, putting in new punctuation. I typed in the word item type in square brackets, but I needed to make sure I put the square brackets around the words item space type so that TMG is going to interpret the square bracket as really being the name of a source element called item type. Don't worry about what item type means. This illustrated the point of adding a source field. And I put in the word source type, and now I'm still inside this field for doing that. Look at the word item type is in lowercase inside the bracket. I think as I click somewhere else out here, it's going to change to all uppercase. It's just kind of a little visual symbol that TMG has received my input, interpreted my input as wanting to add a source element in that field, and signaling me back that all is okay, that it has added that item type source field inside this bibliography template, and that item type is recognized as a valid source element. So these little visual subtle things happen in TMG, not big flags going up, but when you start catching these little things, they signify important stuff to you. If I had put in item type, let me go back here, back to base for the word X. Okay, that's not a valid item type. suddenly thought that was a field. So it doesn't necessarily tell you every error you made, but it is going to tell you that it received the template. There are other places where that error is going to pop up. Now you see the word overwritten. That says the template's been modified. I should have pointed this out before I started here. I'm back here. And
you can add source elements
in the source definition field that are not used in any of the templates. So earlier I was talking about modifying the templates. There are ways in which you can add elements. Another way you can add elements is just click on those blanks. And here's a list of the still available, I'll say that very loud, still available source elements. Source elements that have already been used, or source elements that belong to groups that have been used, are no longer available. So let's just say that this Bible record had a compiler, and they had that. Screen size, I'll select the compiler, and see right there another field for compiler. On the compiler as well. I have never learned how these fields are ordered in their presentation in the source definitions. I did a little bit of experimenting one time and I never could figure out how to order. But I added the compiler field. The compiler field is in all lowercase, which means it is not in any of the templates, it has no effect on the templates. But I now have a field where I can record some additional data about this one file by this local modification to the template. And so two ways in which you can do it, you can put a field in and delete the field, or the easier way is to just come in and click on one of the unused ones and select the field, and it's going to give you another field to stick in the information. And again, that's a way of doing local customization. Source definition general tab, so that you can capture some information that you want about a particular source, but not necessarily having to use that field, that source element in the template. That's where I use my session number, because I never print that out as part of my footnotes or bibliography, but it is a way in which I can kind of remind myself that not only did I reference that book, but I made some copies of some pages in that book, and those copies are labeled with that particular number. Good luck on finding that set of papers that has that number on it. I know that I got copies of that information. Okay, I wanted to do another.
But you would only know that accession number or who the compiler was or whatever if you were to go to this particular screen in your database.
Correct.
Right. I mean, it's really of that only. There's no way it would ever be printed out or available to you in any other form in your program, in your project.
Correct. It's not going to appear in any of the footnotes or bibliography, although there are ways in which you can do this of reports and get some of those fields to appear. And that's one of the things I was working on some number of months ago. Now that I put all these session numbers in, and I now print out a list of my sources that have these session numbers. And I didn't really finish that little experiment, but okay, there are ways in which you can get to that information. Let me just cancel all that.
How do you keep track of your numbers if you can't?
Well,
you do a new one.
My numbers are always unique, as far as I can remember today. Because my session number is the day's date plus local 1, local 2, and 3. Rarely do I sit down and gather new data. You know, there have been cases where I've been on a field trip around the free library, and the one that opens at 9 in the morning, then the one that opens in the day, and the one that closes at 9 at night. So I might also have separate ends here. You start getting copies of 20 pages, so I don't copy a lot, but I'm trying to go to all these libraries and every bit of data I can find. So rather than spend quite a lot of time entering data into TMG, I'd rather find the data, Xerox it on the title information, stamp it, put it together, and go to the next data facility, book, whatever. Find the data, and then several days later, I then go through my stack of junk and information and try to digest it. my session number again is 8 plus the sequence number 5. And I have a journal. I keep a journal of this. Through there, you'll see some scritches and scratches and stuff like that that you'll all see. You'll see a lot of it. I have my little session. It's kind of my thing that kind of reminds me of some additional stuff about that document. And I clearly had it on that stack of paper. And you know, going to the family history library after this meeting, which reminds me what the film is going to look at. The other little thing I want to show you here is making similar changes at the global level. So I come in Tools, Source Types, and I'm going to Bible Records, and I'm going to edit the Bible Records. And I'm going to do kind of a, not meant to be sacrilegious, but my apologies. I changed this record the other day, and I forgot to clean it out, so I'm just going to the baptismal record. And I'm going to say, I want to edit the baptismal record, and I want to say, who was the author of the baptismal record? And from this day forward, I want to make sure I always capture the author of the baptismal record. Maybe nonsensical information. So I put in author, period, and then put a little space there for plainness, and then click out there and say, oh, yep, the word author is legitimate. And now, when I hit the word OK, every baptismal record source in my database is going to suddenly have a new field called author appearing in that source data field. And every new type I put in a new baptismal record, it's going to say, who was the author of that baptismal record? So I make a very simple change in the template for the source type. And when I hit OK, that is now going to appear in every source type. So if I came in and said, master source list, add a source, a baptismal record type, select. Now you see that author field that wasn't there is now something that TMG is going to always ask me for. And let me just do did. And I go over to the template and I say preview, and right there, disregard the unknown repository and the unknown author. I put in zero data in a required field. So whenever I do a preview or print, it's going to type out the words unknown author. Kind of my reminder that this is a mandatory field, and I put in no information about it. Make one little point here. Notice this record has repository address and repository, and I will make the point in a minute, but let's just say that the repository for that record Longview Regional Library. Now I have linked in repository information for that record. And so when I go to the output, and the output says that the bibliography needs to give me a repository address, it gives me the address of the Longview Library. So the repository information comes from the linked in repository record. If you found a book three different libraries, you should have that recorded as three different repositories where the book resides. But the repository address will only be from the first of those libraries. It's not going to take every one of the libraries when it prints out a bibliography. It's only going to take the first of the one that you list. Okay, about time for a break, but I have a few more charts to show. Where are the elements? Okay, I just got into this. The data elements that are used to compose. Full footnote, short put the bibliography may come from a variety of sources. Most of the data is in the source definition general tab. We've been playing with that. Some of that data is actually in the source definition supplemental tab. That's where the source comments are located. Also, the attachment tab links to the repository, and I just illustrated that. If you don't link to a repository, then when it builds a bibliography item or equipment item, it can't look up the repository information. And then in footnotes, it can also use footnotes that have citation detail, citation memo, and citation reference. We've been through most, so all of these can come together to create, the sources that we're creating footnotes. Very quickly, source definition, general tab, the abbreviation, which is a non-field or non-source field. And then I have this little green arrow pointing to title. And then there can be 14 source element fields that are used on the source definition screen. No more than that can go on that screen. Kind of pointed it out, but required fields like title are all going to appear in mixed case. Optional fields, as with the way in which you do the template, are going to have a little angle bracket. And the field that's not used will be all in lowercase and only in illustration. The supplemental tab right here. See the words comments? They have that little angle bracket. So that says that is a conditional field in one of the templates. So the comments, if there are comments there, they will be used in one of the footnote or bibliography templates. But if the comment field is blank, then nothing's going to appear in that template. So there's a supplemental tab in the comments. Here is the attachment field that links to the repository. There's the repository link. You might also notice in that reference right there, that's where I put the call number for a book. So if I had that Hallville Cemetery book from the Longview Public Library, its call number in that book is Jen. Jen 976.419.2.H15. If I found the same book in the Virginia room here in Fairfax, the 991999 sometimes had a different call. So the coordinates also being in that repository, but I would stick in the reference field the call number at that library. So there's the repository reference or call number. Here's the repository. Here's the repository field. Here's the repository information. Here's the repository memo. Again, these are all little data fields that can be pulled together to create the templates for footnotes and bibliographies. And here's the output. We've gone through this several times. Again, all those come together to create that. We mentioned this earlier, but I'll reiterate it. If you see a data element name that appears in just a mixed case, that means like short title, that means it's required, and if it's missing, it's going to tell you if the value is missing when it prints out the template. If an element name appears and it's in all lowercase, as the example of author address, then you can input data on there, but it's not used in any of the templates. And then if it has the little angle brackets around it, that says it's optional. If it's there, then it has any text will appear in the output. Otherwise, it's not going to create an error. Source elements are in groups. Last little data point, and we'll take a break. This is a very important point as you start to create templates, either modifying templates or creating them from scratch. Every source element is a member of a group. Source element name is unique. A source element group name is unique. A source element can belong to only one group. Terry Reba called these cubby holes. And I'm not so sure that was the right description, but now I couldn't think of another image. So there are 32 groups. You can either add or delete a source element. Each group has a name. Each group has one or more source element that belongs to that group. This is important when you get to composing your template. There's some number of source elements I could not get myself a good count. 100, 150 source elements that come into EG. You can add source elements. I think the number is probably unlimited. Deleting the source element once it's been added is tricky. Try it, may work, may not work. And you will hit the error message why it doesn't work. Source elements that are named are unique. There's special treatment that way you handle that. And every element belongs to one group and only one group. Let's illustrate that. Here's a list of source element groups. This is not all 32, this is certain ones. Source element group, author, compiler, date, edition, editor, etc. Typical source element names, which are made as members of those groups. Author includes the element name, agent, author, first party, former, speaker. Compiler group has only one element that's used in compiler. That you can add more element names if you want. Date, there are a variety of element names. The important thing here is two things. First of all, you will notice that source element group names can also be the same as a source element name. And this gets kind of confusing. But you see the author group includes an element called author. The date element group includes an element called date. File reference includes an element called file reference. You really have to kind of work with this eventually and have a kind of aha moment at the end of realizing what's happening here. But when you are constructing templates, you are referencing source elements. And you are composing the templates by naming the source elements. A template, in fact, all of the templates that you're using, can only use one source element name for a group, and can only use that one source element name throughout all the templates. So, you may call an author an informant in a template, but you cannot also call another field as the speaker or the author or the user. Because you've already used first party, which is the one and only one source element out of the author group that you can use in that template. You can call a field file date. That's maybe the word you want me to say. File date is part of the footnote. But you cannot also have a compile date in that same template. You can only use one source element that is the name for a source group. So in many respects, think about source element names as being synonyms or also known as names or groups. And to be honest with you, while you can go create additional source element names, for example, I could add a source element compiling organization as a new source element name for compiler. After TMG put in the ability for you to put in reference notes that will appear when you're doing a source citation, I think the requirement to generate all of these more specific names kind of disappeared. Use one name and still explain to the person at input, which is almost always me, what that name means. An example which I'll show after a break is that the author of certain church records that I'm dealing with is really the name of the church. So if I want to call it church, I want to call it author. I go ahead and call it author, and I put in a note to remind myself that where I use the word author, I mean the name of the church. It's kind of a confusing point, kind of like a Chinese menu. You only pick one from the author group, one from the date group, one from the location group. Some group names are specific some element groups are meant to hold the name, author, compiler, editor, and second person. They're formatted in accordance with style guides. You can put in the ID for a person in your database and it will pop out that name. And when you have author, compiler, editor, and second person, you have to be extremely careful when you stick in any punctuation in a person's name that may be misinterpreted. Examples of names are Clark, Cummins, John, you put it in. Or if you have multiple people, you put the names Menard, comma, Roger P, semicolon, Reamer, comma, Shirley J. And now, in that name field, however it composes the footnote or bibliography, it's going to move first names and last names around in accordance with the style guide. If you have a author, compiler, editor, second person is not really a person like Parrish or St. John. Just put it in, but don't use any commas, semicolons, or numbers, and everything will come out okay. Type in Parrish or St. John, pull out Parrish or St. John. Testing your work, we've done a little bit with preview, and we kind of carry to test your work when you're doing a resource type. It's a lot easier to test your work when you're doing a change to the public from one specific source. And I will demonstrate. Let me take a break now, and I'll do this little demonstration. I'll get into some work for about 15 minutes.
Yeah. Okay.